Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that is teachthegeek.com. Today, my guest is Elisa Carpio. She's a director of product and a tech evangelist. Whenever I think about evangelism, I think of the church, but I'm pretty sure what she does has nothing to do with God. So I'm really interested to learn more about tech evangelism. She's also on the advisory board of Dev Network, a global community for technical professionals. So I'm interested to learn about that as well. So welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Elisa.
Oh my gosh. Welcome. I'm so excited to be a part of this. And I really loved your welcome introduction and honored to be part of Teach the Geek. Thanks Great. For having me.
You got it. So from the bit of research I did on you, I saw that you studied chemistry in school. What was the motivation to study chemistry?
So you're going to laugh about this, but I'm going to use the word truthiness, and you probably know who that came from. But I love science and math because there was such truthiness to it. There was no gray areas in math or in chemistry in general, because so much of chemistry is actually math. And bad things can happen when certain things are put together. And great things can happen when, the right elements are put together. So that's partly why I loved it. Now, I went to UCSD, University of California, San Diego. And in many of the UC systems, when you do study things like biochem or chemistry, you do have to study courses in computer science. So you actually have to code.
Oh, wow. Okay. I did not know that, because when I hear chemistry, I don't necessarily think coding, but I guess if the school says you got to do it, you got to do it.
I remember
when I was my first year, I did engineering in undergrad, and I had to take a coding class my first semester, and that was terrible. It made me realize that coding is not for me. I got to focus on something else outside of this if I want to get this engineering degree. So luckily, it was the one and only coding class I had to take. So you graduate with this chemistry degree. So what type of work did you do once you graduated?
Yeah, I actually went to both undergrad and grad school. But in undergrad, after graduating, I'll be honest with you, I wanted to go to school at some point. I know my mother, who is a surgeon, wanted me to be a doctor because she saw like the lights, right? Like, oh, chemistry, yes. Pharmacology, she wanted me to go there. But I didn't want to go there. I had many aspirations to do research, and I really actually enjoyed coding. I actually really enjoyed solving problems through code and expressing my ideas through code. But right after undergrad at UCSD, I ended up traveling. This is probably going to sound so cliche, but I did the whole backpacking through Mexico. And I'm old, because I'm going to say it right now, I didn't have a smartphone. My friends and I didn't have it at the time. And so we had maps, and we told each other, be here on this day, be here on that day. So I did that. I did a bunch of traveling. I also did a bunch of different jobs, from writing obituaries for a newspaper to working in a lab, a research lab at Scripps, to doing summer at Girl Scouts camp as a camp counselor. So I did all sorts of things. And the reason for that was, it actually came from someone who I admired, and it was one of my doctors. It was Dr. Knife Chief. And I still remember, I love his name. He was my doctor during college. And I remember him saying that, I think it was my junior year when he went back to the reservation to give back to his community. And he said, you know what? You have one life to live. Do it all. And don't just think about school. There's so much more to life than school. And so I took that to heart and definitely experienced life. And that is the one thing that I always tell interns, especially software engineering interns, because so many of our students, right after they graduate, they may even give themselves just a month, and then they go straight into work. And I always kind of say, there's so much more. And you are going to be such a better technologist when you have more experiences in life. But after grad school, I decided after 2.5 years of that, of trying all sorts of things, after grad school, actually, I was an intern at HP Barcelona during grad school. And then after graduating from that, I decided to join Intuit, you know, the makers of TurboTax and QuickBooks.
Nice. You know, when you were talking, Elisa, it reminded me of my own background. So my father wanted me to be a doctor as well, even though, well, unlike your mother, he wasn't even a doctor. He just wanted me to be a doctor for whatever reason. I'm guessing maybe the prestige of it, maybe the just having a job that was more stable, the stability, that's the word, stability of it. But ultimately, I think I came to the same conclusion that you did, although I didn't have a professor or a doctor, your own doctor telling you this. Is just, you have to live your life for yourself, not for the wants of others. So I'm glad that you came to that conclusion when you did and didn't end up becoming a doctor because your mother wanted you to become one and then you're going to be miserable being a doctor. Sometimes I wonder how many people became doctors and lawyers and all these other, you know, these top tier type of professions because their parents wanted them to be it and they never really wanted it themselves. And they actually went through with it. And now they're working as a doctor and they're just thinking, I can't stand this, but they maybe feel this pressure to keep doing it because their parents brag about them being a doctor to their friends and family. And everyone just knows them now as this doctor. And it's never something they wanted to do. And they just feel this pressure to continue to do it.
I love that you said that because the founder of Girls Who Code, right, and the author of Brave Not Perfect, she became a lawyer because of her parents and because of her family. And after, you know, years of being a lawyer, she realized this wasn't for her and she was miserable. But it took some courage for her and bravery to actually leave that, run for office. She didn't make it. But then later on, she founded an organization that is helping so many young women, you know, discover technology, discover that this is their passion and this is how they're going to make an impact in the world. So very wise words, Neil. Very wise words.
All right. Well, they stem from your words. So I guess maybe we're both wise. Well, let's split the difference. So you mentioned that you started working in Intuit. And yes, I do know them. I've used TurboTax a time or two. Save me some money. Thank you, TurboTax.
Yay, TurboTax.
Yes. But I also mentioned that you're now a director of product. And whenever I hear that term, I'm not exactly sure what that means. And maybe there's other people that are not really sure what that means. So as a director of product, what do you do?
Yeah, so I want to make sure that everyone knows that I actually started as an engineer. And I found my way to product management because I was inspired by the product managers that I was working with and how they can tell stories and how they can actually bring people along to really like feel the need of the customer and the problems of the customer. You know, as an engineer, we don't just go into engineering just so we could code, right? We go into because we want to make a difference in the world. And so product management is something that I later on went into, and I have I do have a career path that looks more like a Rorschach drawing than a ladder. And so I've tried many different things, including a stint as a social media manager. And but the director of product management is someone that, and this is how I'm going to define it. I know it's defined by many, many different ways. And Marty Kagan definitely will define it differently from how I'm going to define it. But product management is a discipline. And you are definitely the guardians of, and the voice, you represent the voice of the customer, but you are the guardians of the product and those solutions for the customer. As a director of product management, I believe that you or me, you need to be someone that is not only passionate about the customer, but passionate about the discipline, and that you are there as someone who can grow other product managers to not only embrace the customer need, but embrace the discipline itself. So as a director, I believe my role is to teach the discipline of product management. But I also am a bit of, you know, just like others who transition to product management from engineering, I bring a different set of skills because I'm coming at it from a technologist perspective and not necessarily just from a business perspective. So I think as a director of product management, you're a few things. You are a product manager. So you do look out for the voice of the customer, but you're also the steward of the discipline itself. And then you should be coaching and mentoring others.
Wow. you know, well, what you do is interesting, but then even the route you took to get there was even more interesting. I mean, you mentioned a bunch of stuff. I mean, the doctor thing didn't work out. Sorry, Mom. But then you were a camp counselor, you wrote obituaries, you worked in a lab, you did social media, you were an engineer at one point, and then, you know what, product management, let's give it a go. I really like your attitude about just approaching your working life and not thinking that because you started off one place, you have to stay in that particular place. And that's another thing. Even when I was thinking about the people who ended up doctors, didn't want to be doctors.
Yes.
You have people that studied something that maybe they even wanted to study. So maybe they actually went to school to be an engineer and then they started working as one and think that this is something you have to continue to do, but it's not. I mean, you can branch out into other things and see if you like that as well. I mean, just because you start off one place doesn't mean that's where you have to stay your entire working life.
Okay. So there you are again, super wisdom here from Neil. And I think about what you just said, it just makes me think about that last speech that Steve Jobs said around connecting the dots and to trust that the dots will connect. I think everything that you do lends itself to that next adventure in your career and in your life, right? So nothing is wasted. So when people go, oh my God, you're an engineer. God, you wasted that. Now you're in whatever you do. I'm like, it's not a waste because everything started there. Everything started in tech and everything started with the understanding of this truthiness for me of math and science. And so I don't see anything as a waste in anyone's journey. I think we can learn from everyone and anyone. And I love Teach the Geek because to be honest, I watched the last three episodes that you had and I was learning from folks. I think we all arrive where we are from the wisdom and experience that others share with us. And I'm always, I know people kind of go, oh man, did you get that feedback? I'm like, yeah, but feedback for me is like vitamins. I get it daily and it's in the hopes of, you know, being better and getting better.
Yeah. I mean, and another thing I was thinking about when you were talking, Elisa, has to do with even making those type of changes and being at companies that allow you to do that.
Yes.
Because oftentimes you, and even if you want to change careers, I mean, you were in engineering, you want to get into product management. That's a company you have to convince that even though I have this engineering background, I can still do this product management. And that might be difficult to do at certain companies. They may look at you and say, well, you don't have product management experience, so we're not going to give you a product management job. But if you have people who are more open-minded that can see that even though you have this background that isn't typical perhaps, but because you have this curiosity to learn what this new job will entail, you'll probably be, you know, just as good, if not better, than the people who've been doing it, because to them it's old hat. It's just rinse and repeat. But for you, it's, let's try this. Like, maybe this can work too. And you know, you come with it from a fresh, you come with a fresh pair of eyes.
Oh my gosh. Thank you, Neil. I need you as like my backup fan, because I have some days when I'm like, oh God, this isn't working. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. I totally believe in that. And I actually preach that same thing that you're saying. And more recently, I've mentored a couple of engineers who moved into product management. And you know, one of the first things that they said to me was, you're right. You know, I always tell people, start with the tech, put 2 to 3 years in as a software engineer or as, you know, an engineer, and then branch from there. And I think there's a myth that in many enterprise tech companies that you get stuck. In reality, that myth is definitely a myth, because in many companies, you can definitely traverse different job bands and try different things. It is much more, not forgiving, but it's much more open than many people think.
Nice. You know, I also mentioned in the intro that you're into tech evangelism.
Yes.
So when it comes to the tech space, what exactly does evangelism entail and how did you get into it?
Yeah. So tech evangelism is actually something that as I did my research on the career itself, it's actually Microsoft who started it more than 20 years ago. And it started off traditionally, and it still is for many tech evangelists, where they take a platform or a set of products, set of suites, and they try to get engineers to adopt it, technologists to adopt the technology. They are usually not only the spokesperson, but they know that product and platform really, really well. And so evangelism is a bit of understanding not just the business, but it's also understanding the customer and being someone of a spokesperson and being someone that brings community together. So for me, I ended up in my evangelist role actually at Intuit, and I was sought by two VPs there. And it was only because I did a stint as a social media manager, did a stint in communications as an engineer and a product manager. And what you actually need as a tech evangelist is a bit of everything. You need to understand the business. You need to have tech chops. You need to be able to be someone who loves building community and talking to others. And you need to be, I call it creatively brave. And that's partly why my website is called creativelybrave.me. You need to have some creativity in there because adoption is all about change management, changing people's mindset, you know, of doing things differently the way than how they were doing it before. So it is not religion. You evangelize through adoption and through building community.
Nice. Yeah, I also mentioned in the intro your affiliation with Dev Network, and I gave a brief definition of what Dev Network is. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about what it is and how you got involved with it.
Yes, so the network is a community of technologists that put together different events from Dev Week Global to other events that are focused on on APIs. As an advisory board member, I actually found my way through this. I was asked to be a part of it and very glad to be a part of it because I've spoken at one of the Dev Week Global sessions or conferences. And then a few years ago, when I was still at Intuit, I worked with marketing to host a booth for Intuit at Dev Week. And the reason why I am passionate about being part of the network, Dev Network, is because it isn't a one size fits all kind of model. They have many different programs and many different events that span from, security all the way to AI and all the way to more, I would say, I don't want to call generic, but more, general terms of software engineering. But what I also like about it is that the network itself, the advisory board, is made up of a community, a set of thought leaders and community members who can learn from each other and where we can also build our own networks and our own community.
Nice. That's an excellent community to be a part of. And I'm glad that it exists. And the main reason is, even though the reason I started this whole podcast and YouTube channel was that technical people aren't necessarily known as the best at communicating with others. As I certainly wasn't very good at it at first, but I certainly saw the benefit of getting better at it over time. So if there's an organization that champions that and helps people to even be able to do it, talking about things that they are actually passionate about or interested in, then I don't see any downside to it. So I'm glad that it's there.
Yeah, no. And the other thing I do want to mention is, I don't know if you know this, Neil, but in most tech conferences, the diversity of its attendees and its presenters is quite low. At best, you will get 22 to 28% of attendees and speakers at any tech conference are women in tech. And yet, what I really like about being part of the network, the Dev Network, and all of the Dev Week events, is that they really try hard to increase that diversity of voices and backgrounds. So there's a lot of pluses for the community and for the individuals who are part of it.
Wonderful. I mentioned just now that I started this whole endeavor with the podcast and the YouTube channel because of my own struggles giving presentations in front of others, but I eventually saw the light. My project got canceled. So that was the the wake-up call that I needed, that maybe I wasn't the best at communicating this project status to these senior management types. When did you realize that being proficient or being effective at giving presentations or public speaking in general could be of use to you?
Oh my gosh, Neil, this is such a big, big, big thing. And I think, Neil, you can definitely relate to what I'm about to say, which is back at school, we weren't graded for presenting, for being great public speakers or being great writers. We weren't. We were graded for the projects and the code that we deliver. And yet in corporations, whether startups or not, we are actually looked at by the way that we tell a story, by the way that we bring others and provide context and framing to what we're working on, and being able to tell people the progress of our projects. So it's this huge realization for me. Let me tell you, there was two scenarios. The first was, I was working in a lab, this was after undergrad, and the lead actually couldn't speak. We had to talk about our project, and I was kind of like his lowly helper, and he couldn't speak, and he started kind of shaking, and it was in front of investors, it was in front of, you know, senior leaders, and basically he looked to me, and I knew what the work was, and I stepped in, and I talked about what we were trying to, what we were solving, and how we solved it, and then I shared the data, and it actually what ended up being a serendipitous moment, because it ended up leading to opportunities for me to travel at different parts of the world to talk about our project and to talk about the data. And so that was like the first, oh, there's something to this. So I'm not just getting looked at for my results. It's really important to be able to communicate the results and the impact to the business and the impact to your customer. And then the second time that I really saw this come to life was when I was an engineer at Intuit, and I saw how product managers told stories, and it made you want to be a part of the team, and it made you want to do better for the customer. Gosh, I'm going to need to invest into this skill.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you saw it early on when you were even in undergrad, or just after undergrad with your professor. For me, it was many, many years later.
Well, you know, we all have different roads, Neil.
Better late than never. That's
exactly,
for sure.
Exactly. There's never late. I'm still trying to hone in my craft. I'm now, as a director, trying to figure out how do I actually connect with other senior level leaders, because they have different ways of wanting their information, because there's a lot coming at them. And more recently, I got feedback even from my current leader, who's a VP and chief architect. And he said, Alisa, you know, I love the context you give, but I need the bottom line. And so I'm switching things to like, talk about the bottom line first, and then I give you context. So, you know, I'm trying to learn always, how do I best communicate effectively?
Well, you know, when it comes down to it, it's just knowing your audience. So you just, once you figure out what they want to know, then you just present that and leave it and make it and call it a day.
Exactly. Some lessons are harder.
No doubt. Exactly. I get it. So when it comes to the presentations that you do, do you have a process of putting them together? And if so, what is it?
Yes. So I learned this actually from a director. She is now like an angel investor. Her name is Vidya Dinamani. And I learned this from her. And I always teach this. You start at the end. You start by asking yourself, what outcome do you want out of this? And in second, what feeling do you want for your audience to come away with? And so the outcome, let me start with that one. The outcome is, what are the key takeaways that you want? If no one else remembered anything that you said in the last 15 minutes or however long your talk is, what do you want them to take away? And apparently there's cognitive burden of learning more than 5 things. So I always try to hit 2 to 3. So I always start with that. And then the second is, what feelings do you want? Do you want them to feel inspired? Do you want them to be informed? Do you want them to take action? So you need to understand what it is that you want out of those two things, right? The emotion and the outcome. And if you start from the outcome, then you work your way backwards into understanding the chapters of your talk. So if this is what I want, what are the chapters of my talk that will lead me there? Well, and I do use Malcolm Gladwell's tip where he says, you know, number your chapters. So I just kind of write on stickies and then I put them in order. I number them.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. I really like the idea of starting at the end and working backwards, because what it also does is it eliminates any fluff. So everything that you're coming up with is going, yes, towards whatever you want that outcome, yes, to be. And yeah, when you mentioned the cognitive burden, I can definitely relate to that, because if you're an expert in something, you probably want to talk all about it. But
yes.
especially if you're talking to a non-technical audience, they may not know half of what you know. And so you're just overloading with a whole bunch of stuff. And they're just like, you know what? I don't know if I want to listen anymore. I'm gonna think about what I'm going to have for lunch. You know, I had Thai yesterday, so maybe I'll have Mexican today.
What's the one thing that, what did this person just say? You know, John Maida, I went to his talk. I don't know if you know him, but he's like amazing. He said this one thing and I was like, oh my God, you're so right. He said, people are not for you. They're not against you. They're in it for themselves. And so you need to answer always, what is in it for them? And so I love that, because I love what you said, because I think many of us can geek out, can go deep in our topics and our subjects. And then we realize, I don't think anyone really cared about like the last 50% of this, except for me. So thanks, Neil. It's a good reminder.
Yeah. You know, sometimes if you look up from your notes, you look up from the screen that you're reading, hopefully you're not reading, but if you do, you'll look at the audience and you'll see the blank stares in their faces. You'll see them looking at their phones. You'll see them falling asleep. You'll see them staring into space. You'll see all of this. If you want to pay attention, like maybe I need to move it on, move it along. Maybe I need to wrap it up.
Oh man, it's hard to be a stand-up comic, man. That's probably the hardest job, but I definitely. There's a bit of entertainment too in every talk. People kind of go, no, Lisa, all they really care about is the topic. I'm like, no, I'm telling you, there's a story that you got to tell. And there's a bit of entertainment. If you don't believe that, you're going to lose most of your audience.
Oh, when it comes to just speaking in public, I very much look up to stand-up comedians, because not only do they have to keep people's attention, but they have to be funny while doing it. And humor is subjective. So you may be saying something that worked in this one crowd, then you try it on this other crowd and it falls completely flat. And now what do? You better move it along. You better find something else or you're going to lose them.
Exactly. Pivot on the spot. I mean, I see it all the time, right? I do think that they have the hardest job in the world. 100%. Maybe rocket scientists too, but they have the hardest job in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think I put rocket scientists over comedians, but it's comedians up there though.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So what if for the people who are listening to this conversation or watching it, what would your number one tip be for them to become more effective at public speaking?
I have maybe three. The first is to tell yourself that you are good enough. There's a reason why you've been chosen, and there's a reason why you're up there on stage or on Zoom. So tell yourself you're good enough. The second is, when you're public speaking, just know that you're going to have butterflies. And I love what Cara DeFrias one time told me. I was speaking at a TEDx salon, and she said, just eat them. Just own that you're going to be nervous and just eat your butterflies. And don't forget that you are telling a story. And so pauses are great to be able to hone in on that point. Pause. Don't rush into the three things you need to go through. Pause, find those pauses in your takeaways, in your story, that will really drive home the message.
All right. I asked for one, I got three. So let's go through the three. I really like them. You're good enough. Absolutely. If you don't think so, then you'll never even try. So you definitely, and not only that, but if you tell yourself that you're not good at it, then you definitely won't try. And you don't get better at things unless you do them. So that's a good one. You'll be nervous. So yes, I fully believe that you will be nervous, and nerves is just a sign that you actually care about the outcome. If you weren't nervous, and it's likely it's because you don't really care about what's going on or what's happening with this presentation. I don't know about eating butterflies. I've never eaten a butterfly before.
But basically acknowledge that you are nervous and own it, right? Own it, and don't like try to get rid of them. Just eat them. Just take it in and say, you're nervous. It's fine. You'll get through it. Just get through the first two or three sentences, and your butterflies will stay with you. But just know it isn't something that you could say, I'm not nervous, I got this. Just know, like, every single person, I don't know anyone, like even actors say it, like they're nervous and they're always in front of the camera.
Yeah. And then I really like your point about pauses as well. And what pauses mm-hmm. do is it minimizes the use of filler words. So oftentimes we'll use words like so to fill up those pauses or fill up those spaces. And if you pause instead, that's less distracting than filler words. In fact, I had, well, my mother once called me after one of my episodes went live, and she told me that she couldn't listen to it past about a couple of minutes because the guests that I had used so many filler words, she found it so distracting, she stopped listening. And I just remember thinking to myself, I wonder how many other people stop listening to my podcast or any podcast because of filler words. And what it does, it's so unfortunate, especially if you have something important to say and you're speaking to people who really need to hear what you have to say, that you're turning them off simply because you use filler words as opposed to pauses.
Yes. I think also when we don't pause, we don't realize that our audience is still catching up with us. Right. And we have these three great things. I'm going to go straight through, like I'm reading it. And the reality is that you got to put even a second or two pause there for them to go, oh, that's brilliant. Oh, let me take that. Right. So I learned that, actually from taking a course, in acting, and how pausing is actually great for storytelling.
Yeah, I could totally see that. But hopefully when you take that pause and you expect them to think that this is amazing, they better think so. And I better hear the awes. I better hear that. If I don't see it, I'm like, oh, they didn't think that was as great as I thought it was.
Oh, then. I thought it was brilliant.
I thought it was cool. My mom thought it was cool. Whatever. Tell these people.
You know, that's Alisa, all that matters. Your mom thought it was cool.
Yeah, mom always calls whatever she tells me about podcasts. Great job, son. She never does a bad job. Not once. The other people, they can improve, but you, son, you're killing it.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. That's hilarious.
This has been a great conversation, Alisa. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you.
How can people get in touch with you?
Sure. Get in touch with me through LinkedIn, Alisa Carpio. I'm definitely active on there. You know, connect with me, message me directly. You can also check out my website and send me an email through there. And my website is creativelybrave.me.
Excellent. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson, founder of Teach the Geek. You can find out more about it at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Alisa.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms. Or on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.